What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
NFL Total Access, the podcast, is getting you ready for the 2024 NFL Draft. I'm your host, Andrew Levy, and I'll be delivering 2 shows a week to make sure you're caught up on the very latest NFL news, including every free agency move and how it changes the draft needs of your favorite team. Draft experts and talent scouts, mock drafts, and a few shock drafts, too. NFL Total Access, the podcast, is already on the clock on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On this Memorial Day, we bring you a story that's just been declassified by the U.S. military. It's the tale of a larger-than-life pro wrestler and the soldiers he trained in how to be American. SI senior writer John Wertheim takes it from here.
I came across this story by happenstance, as so often happens. I was doing a piece for 60 Minutes on the Ritchie Boys. The Ritchie Boys are really this remarkable unit of German speakers, primarily some Italian speakers as well, who not only spoke the language, but knew the subtleties and the sports teams and the comic books. They really had a grasp of the culture, which made them really good spies and interrogators. But in the course of the research, it was just sort of, you know, a sentence in a book. The great hand-to-hand combat instructor at Camp Ritchie was a prominent professional wrestler. Who was this prominent professional wrestler in the first half of the 20th century who ended up in this secretive camp? Camp Ritchie was, and for that matter is, a resort in the Blue Ridge Mountains right on the Maryland side of the state line with Pennsylvania. In World War II, it was used as a special interrogation center. The U.S. military realized you had a lot of German and Italians, especially German Jews, who'd fled the Nazis, come to the U.S., and they still knew the dialect, they knew the culture, they spoke fluent German. Hey, this could be really valuable in this war, both at home and abroad. So all of a sudden, Army base was set up. It was for the least likely soldiers imaginable, which were German and Italian-speaking immigrants who now obviously were loyal to the United States. A lot of these guys came with musical instruments in their books. They had never held knives or fired rifles in their life. And there was a rumor floating around the camp that a professional wrestler and actor was going to teach them hand-to-hand combat. This would be like showing up for basic training and, hey, this guy, The Rock, might be our instructor tomorrow. They realized it really was this professional wrestler, Man Mountain Dean, when they saw a guy trying to make a call from a payphone, but only his arm could fit into the booth. It was against that backdrop that these unlikely soldiers realized that, yes, this famous professional wrestler really was going to be their hand-to-hand combat instructor at Camp Ritchie. Frank Levitt was born in Hell's Kitchen, not necessarily a pro wrestling hotbed. His father worked in the theater district just a few blocks away. He was a very, very large child who was always mistaken for many years older than he was. He also was this great patriot. So as soon as he was eligible, and even beforehand, the story goes, he recruited a quote, Bowery bum to pose as his father and enlist him, and ended up serving in the military before World War I and then during World War I. He played in the fledgling National Football League. In the NFL, there's a story that he pancaked Jim Thorpe. And then he discovered professional wrestling, which was just starting to come of age. And he really took to it. I think part of it was the sport, but part of it was the theatrics, the selling, the touring, and thus began a fairly prominent professional wrestling career. He quit, became a beat cop. Frank Leavitt was friends with Al Capone. Of course he was. Frank Leavitt was serving on the Miami police force. And he becomes friendly with Al Capone. They had friends in common, and you could actually find old Miami Herald articles saying popular officer Frank Leavitt booted off the force because of his friendship with Al Capone. This was covered by all the South Florida newspapers. One effect is that it ended up sort of reviving his professional wrestling career. He couldn't be a cop in Miami. That's a pretty good job. He met his wife that way, but he couldn't be a cop in Miami anymore. What am I going to do? Well, maybe it's time to rethink this professional wrestling, and it really propelled him to go back into pro wrestling, and that's when he really had this big career break. These are the early days of professional wrestling, but even then, you know, you needed a nickname. His first nickname was the Hell's Kitchen Hillbilly. If you've been to Hell's Kitchen, it is a lot of things, but a fertile basin of hillbillies, it is not. So that didn't really catch on. We often say this in sports writing, oh, this is a character right out of Runyon. In this case, there really was a connection to Runyon, that they knew each other. And it was Damon Runyon who suggested the next nickname for Frank Leavitt, which was Stone Mountain, named after a town in Georgia. Not bad, but that didn't really catch on. At one point, he went by Man Mountain Leavitt, which was his real last name, but Frank Leavitt's wife shrewdly decided that Leavitt, a Semitic-sounding last name, even though Frank Leavitt was not Jewish, Leavitt might not play well in Nazi Germany, where he was touring at the time. So finally, Man Mountain Dean, which sounds less Semitic than Man Mountain Leavitt, I suppose. Man Mountain Dean ended up being a very prominent professional wrestler in the first half of the 20th century. At one point, he was making $1,500 per match, which was more than the annual per capita income in the United States. There are records of more than 1,000 documented matches all over the world. But no, this is one of the prominent wrestlers of the first half of the 20th century, no doubt. As his body gets older, he realizes he could also make a very nice living as an actor and a stuntman. So he's in a number of films. Remember, he has this theater background. So not only does he have this appreciation for theatrics, but he also has a number of connections. So he rises very quickly in Hollywood. World War II breaks out. He's in his 50s, too old to be on the front lines. But remember, this is a loyal patriot. He enlists and he is assigned. What are we going to do with this guy? It's this big celebrity. He's a World War I veteran. Why don't we make him an instructor at Camp Ritchie? And that's how you have this incredibly unlikely marriage. Think about this. You're 19, 20, 21 years old. You fled the Nazis. Your life has been completely destabilized. It's thrown into chaos. Now you want to go back and fight the Nazis. You're in this country, you're trying to assimilate, but you have an accent, you have a name that isn't particularly common, and here you have this celebrity, movie star, wrestler, celebrity, and he gets it. So what does he do? He slings his arm over Gustav and says, from now on, you're Gus. And I think he really understood that these were young men in a very precarious time who were going to carry out and execute this patriotic duty for this new country against their old country, having been expelled. And he really helped, not just with their sort of morale at the time as young soldiers, but in their Americanization. Who knew that the Ritchie Boys included, there was a Rockefeller, there was J.D. Salinger. Remember the Fodor's guides? Fodor was a Ritchie Boy. These were intellectuals that spoke language, knew German culture, and could help the U.S. military. And a lot of them, you know, they showed up at Normandy. I mean, they weren't just brought into the interrogation tent after the battle. I mean, these guys, a lot of them, they were on the landing crafts at Normandy, the same as thousands and thousands of other GIs. It was all very secretive, which is one reason why it's taken so long for this to come out. This was classified, but this was a very, very effective branch. And the battlefield intelligence that these Ritchie boys gathered on the Western Front, starting in Normandy, but Battle of the Bulge, and throughout Europe up until the liberation of the camps, even through Nuremberg, these Ritchie boys really played a very, very prominent role in World War II. It was just all under wraps. And a lot of these Ritchie boys, they would go on to basically serve in the CIA. I mean, in some ways, this was really ground zero for U.S. espionage in the Cold War. He retires from wrestling and becomes this stuntman, but plenty of downtime. Well, what is he going to do? Among other things, he begins studying journalism. Man Mountain Dean passed away in the early 50s. Ironically enough, his obit was written by Edwin Pope, who would go on to become a longtime sports editor of the Miami Herald and this sort of towering figure in sports journalism. Edwin Pope was at the time, I'm sure, a summer intern. This was a guy with a diversity of interests, fiercely patriotic, but I also think the fact that he was well-read and had this background in Broadway and theater and journalism, I think that's probably what made him well-liked and so effective as an instructor with these young soldiers who were from a different country. They were half his size. They were half his age. But what everybody says is, like, once you got past the, hey, this guy's really famous, there really was this connection between these Camp Ritchie, soldiers in quotes, because they really weren't really combat soldiers. But there was a real connection between the celebrity and these young immigrants that were now going to serve in the U.S. military. There was a real connection there. And they all spoke fondly of him, not as a celebrity, but as someone that they really bonded with. And 75 years later, they still remember the stories and the wisdom he gave them. And I think his background, so diverse, traveling the world from Manhattan, living in Georgia farmland, I think that's one reason he was able to connect with these 19, 20, 20-year-old intellectuals sent to Camp Ritchie so well. The Ritchie boys were phenomenally successful and courageous, and now they're finally getting their due. There have been a number of awards that these guys have gotten late into their 90s, which is really gratifying. One of the guys, I think, was 99 now has hit 100. He's still with us. And they still, with real specificity, they still remember the conversations and the nicknames and the anecdotes and the snoring. I mean, they still really have these very sharp memories of Man Mountain Dean 75 years later. This is really a remarkable guy. I mean, I didn't know anything about him, but Man Mountain Dean was a real patriot. We roll our eyes when we hear the word hero, but I defy you to sort of read his story and then use another term to characterize him. And I also think this is a group, because this was all classified, these Ritchie Boy stories haven't been told, but you go back and you talk to the experts. I talked to a professor at West Point. So listen, more than half the battlefield intelligence on the Western Front was generated from Ritchie Boys. These were really unsung heroes of World War II. And I would submit that their hand-to-hand combat instructor that, yes, he taught them how to disarm a man of his knife and some, but I also think just that the socialization and the fact that this guy made them comfortable and made them sort of understand American culture, he's really a prominent figure in this story as well.
John Wertheim wrote the daily cover, Uncle Slam's Secret Army, which also appears in the magazine. You'll find a link in our show notes. Sports Illustrated Weekly is a production of Sports Illustrated and iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows. And for more of Sports Illustrated's best stories and podcasts, visit si.com. This special episode of Sports Illustrated Weekly was produced by our senior producer, Dan Bloom. Our sound engineer is Isaac Lee. Our executive producers are Scott Brody and me, John Gonzalez. Our theme song is by Nolan Schneider. Thanks for listening, and our regularly scheduled episode of Sports Illustrated Weekly will be in your feed, per usual, on Wednesday.